thanks to everyone for coming. If you have not been to Lightning Talks before, they're kind of fun. They go pretty quickly. The slides automatically advance, and so each of the speakers has, I think, 5 minutes to tell you what they're doing. There won't typically be time for questions in between. Once we press the go, it's going through all of the presentations. There'll just be kind of time to switch and for me to give the title of the next one, although I think at least one of our speakers did just put in some blank slides, and we'll take some questions during that period. Yeah, I see others are thinking for next year. Good idea. All right, so we'll start off. There are a few people who haven't checked in yet, so if they aren't here, we'll use that time. Their slides will still advance, but we'll use that time to let you ask questions for the other people. So we're going to start off with Barry Bosinkuhl doing a talk on RDWD, Managing German Weather Observations.
So if you work in Germany or with weather data from Germany, you have come to the correct place. If not, I hope you can still learn a couple of things. I have written a package to manage the German weather data, which I needed for several projects in my work. So as said, my name is Barry. I am a PhD student at the University of Potsdam. You can take pictures of my slides at any time and do whatever you want with it, as long as you cite me, right? That's the CC BY thing. The package is on CRAN and GitHub. The links are up there, so you can see that. And if you want to get templates like this presentation, you can do that with a function I have. The German Weather Service has a ton of data online since about 3 years. 25,000 data sets with climate observations. That's pretty cool. It's also a bit too much to inspect and to search, and also it's not always quite consistent. They're getting better with it, but, you know. And so the idea is that it's really easy to do. There are two steps. Figure out what URL you need and then download it. For the first part, you can use select DVD. For example, I want the daily climate data for Potsdam and then the recent ones, and it will give me back that long FTP link, which I can then download. In the second step, with the function data DVD, that will download it if it's not already on your drive, or you can also overwrite it. It will call read DVD to unzip the file and then read the data that's in there and convert it into some nice magic. And then it's just a regular data frame in this case that you can do anything with regular R code. For example, you could plot it, figure out which columns you want to see, and you know, just regular plotting stuff, and get a nice plot to see how has daily temperature evolved in the last year and a half. So I pulled together all the metadata and I put that into a large map that I built with Leaflet, so it's interactive. And the easiest way to get that one is through the vignette. And then you can zoom in and pan around and do whatever you do in interactive maps. And then click on the point and see this. It's a bit small, but basically you get information for each station. What files are there? You can copy the first line to get even more detailed information. How many files there are, if there are non-public files as well that you can ask for and then also get. It will also tell you if there is a recent file, because there is also some historical data. I brought two applications. One is, for example, you might be interested in climate graphs. They'll, for Germany, pretty much look all the same, but you would, you know, just get the long-term data, the historical. You can abbreviate historical, and then put that into a temperature and precipitation vector that have the averages of the long term, and then plot that with whatever stuff you have, and then you would be getting the figure there below. If you're familiar with climate graphs, you'll realize that Potsdam has a humid climate, and probably if you're familiar with climate graphs, that's also not surprising. So it's pretty neat. Another application is a project that I've been working on for a long time, extreme rainfall intensity depending on temperature. We see all over the world that that seems to increase, as would be expected, but then decrease again. The green lines are single stations for Germany. Now, if you use a good quantile estimator that's not biased for sample size, you will see that it will continue increasing, which would mean, like, you know, if it gets warmer in our climate, we would expect more extreme rainfall more often, even though we haven't seen it yet. So that's about it. And I actually did build in 60, 40, 20 seconds for questions. So you got that time. Yeah? Sorry? Yeah. Yeah. So the German Weather Service has historical data sets that last sometimes up to 150 years. And those get updated once a year. And then they have recent files that get updated every day, approximately. Yeah.
What's the license of the weather data?
Somewhat, pretty much CC by like, but it's not exactly that. But you can use it. As long as you cite them, it's the same thing there. I think we're also out of time, so thanks for listening.
All right, our next speaker is Michael Dietz. He's going to talk about eSize, a toolbox to weld seismological and geomorphic data analysis.
So I should advance or advance?
It'll do it automatically. Oh,
okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm Michael, also from Potsdam. I'm a geomorphologist, so I work at the processes that shape the Earth, and I use or investigate these by using seismometers. Actually, devices that were made for recording events like these, earthquakes, but you can also use them to investigate processes like these, rock falls. And we're interested in actually the seismic properties of these processes. We also are interested in things like rain splash initiating, soil erosion on the interaction of atmosphere and geosphere, on cliff erosion, on hillslope transport processes, on sediment dynamics in rivers, and also on the fluvial dynamics of rivers. And we investigate all this by these nifty little instruments, which we can carry to catchments we are interested in, deploy there a mobile station for a couple of weeks or even months, and then go back and harvest the data, which mainly means we have to read on all the data, do some imaginary and not so imaginary signal processing, find the needles in the haystacks, which are the events, and then just investigate them, plot them, quantify them. This is what the data actually looks like. We see the seismic imprint of a rockfall. Just we have several collapses or several collisions of the rock with the cliff face, and then we start letting this rock hop down the hill slope. And that's just recorded by 200 samples per second. We can investigate them in the time domain, but also in the spectral domain. So why do we do this in R? First of all, I said one station records about 500 million data points per day. If you do this for 1 year with a network of 10 stations, you end up with a big bunch of data. That's one point. And the other point is you also want to do this in the combination of environmental data sets, topographic data sets, and so on. So we need shared knowledge. Right now, the package has all the functions to import and export the typical seismic data files. We can do all these bunch of signal processing functions. I won't go into these details. We can locate the noisy signals we have, and we can also do some bunch of further plotting functions. What about an example? What is the interaction between atmosphere and Earth, mainly mitigated through trees? So trees are the dominant factors for interference with the wind field. They have been instrumented heavily, but no one has investigated the signals below the surface. This is what we did over here in a forest and in a single tree. And you see the white curve depicts a storm event lasting about 2 days, and this is the seismic energy collected by a forest, and this is just the seismic energy collected by the clearing close by. It's a logarithmic scale. You see the energy of the forest is one or two orders of magnitude higher and really closely follows the wind speed. What we can also do is investigate the seismic or the spatial footprint of a single tree, which decays at the order of some tens of meters, and you do not see this imprint anymore. We can also investigate at sub-hourly or at sub-second resolution the swaying of a tree at the surface displacement, and we can unmix the components of wind and rain by using end-band modeling. What about something with a bit more energy? That's a study of rock falls falling down the 600-meter high cliff in the Alps, which is instrumented by 6 broadband seismometers and has been scanned by terrestrial laser scans simply to see the volumes and the locations of rock falls. That's 1 month of test data. We had 1 month and 10 LIDAR-detected rock falls with volumes ranging from 0.05 cubic meters to up to 2.5 cubic meters, and exactly 2 seismically detected events, and this is the location estimate, which is on average 50 to 100 meters off the actual one. We can also get insight into these processes. We see signals of detachment, then we have 1, 2, 3 collapses, breakdown of the rock mass as it falls down the cliff. We have a silent freefall phase of 6 seconds, and then this powerful impact at the hill slope of the cliff. And that all can be also detected in space. We also get a really precise timestamp on it at the order of a couple of seconds. And this allows us to temporarily link rockfall activity patterns to sources like earthquakes, wind speed, freeze and thaw transitions, and precipitation, and calculate the lag times between these. And then just to get the relative influence of these driving factors. Where next with that package? Obviously, I should do some more benchmarking with established seismic software. I will also grade into more further seismic approaches to locate events, to pick events, to investigate the structure of this. But I also need to speed up these packages and integrate existing Python scripts. And this is something I would really love to talk to someone who feels qualified enough to teach me how to work in Python scripts. So if you're interested in the topic, in the software, in the package itself, just take a look on my website or try to find the eSize package on GitHub. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. All right, next we have Anna Malago, who's going to talk about an R decision support framework for the identification of BMP encatchments.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Anna Malago from the Data Resource Center of the European Commission, and today I'm delighted to be here to talk to you about an application of R to the decision support framework for the identification of best management practice in catchments. I have subdivided my talk in four main parts. I will start with the contested and challenges, then I will talk to you about the R SWOT DM, and I will show you all of its characteristics. Then two case studies briefly, and finally the conclusion. So let's start with the contest. Water, energy, food security is crucial for a sustainable economic growth and human well-being. In addition, these sectors are strongly connected together, so we can talk about the water, energy, food nexus. In this context, the Joint Resource Center provides scientific support to the implementation of the framework, the Water Framework Directive, developing tools and methodologies to predict water quality, water quantity, to identify the best management practice, and also the related economic assessment. This is very important, but their allocation is a very complex task because the best management practice, their cost and efficiencies can change depending on several aspects. The simulation of the best management practice was done using the model SWOT. This model is an equihydrological model, semi-distributed. It is applied at large scale in general, and it is a continuous model. But using only this model, we can't do economic assessment. For that reason, we have developed this framework, the R-SWOT-DM, that allow to implement together the hydrological modeling, the economical model, and also the optimizational tools. In particular, we have developed in R the mathematical and statistical algorithms, and we have used a lot of packages, starting, for instance, from packages related to the communication with SWOT and R, other packages related to the optimization and visualization and map, such as we have used a lot of the ggplot tool. Here we can see the structure of our framework. We can do several execution types. We can do individual simulation, interactive simulation, and also multi-criteria optimization. And also we can change a lot of best management practice. Here we can see an example of two important files of SWOT that we can change using directly R. The first is related to agriculture management, and the second is related to the point sources. In particular, we can change, for instance, the schedule of irrigation, of the schedule related to the fertilization. And here you can see the outputs analysis that we can automatically generate with our framework. We can compare scenario analysis, and also we can generate maps of our results in terms of with the different maps. Here The first case study, this is the Upper Danube. The goals of these important studies was to define the optimal solution, the optimal best management practice to reduce the pollution of nitrate in rivers, but at the same time increase the global income. To achieve this important target, we have implemented our framework, an economic model that describes the agriculture income related to the fertilization. We have upgraded our wastewater treatment plant and air course, and we have defined an environmental objective. The second case study is the Crete Island. Here we have applied the same approach of the Upper Danube, but with a different objective. In this particular case, we found the best solution for decreasing the cost of irrigation, but increasing the crop income. So our framework helps a lot the stakeholder to understand the baseline of our simulation, and in the same time you are able to define which is the best management practice to reduce the pollution in our river at European scale. That's all. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Bart Rogiers. I'm a hydrogeologist and R enthusiast at the Belgian Nuclear Research Center. And I'll be talking in the next 5 minutes about some R code I have collected in the past few years to do groundwater flow modeling and solute transport modeling from within R. So we're going to look at this from the perspective of reproducible research. So to illustrate the problem there, just have a look at the first journal paper title I'm listing here. Most computational hydrology is not reproducible, so is it really science? So clearly we have some issues in subsurface hydrology or in computational hydrology. Luckily, R offers many great tools for doing reproducible research. And a good thing about these tools is that they are basically applicable to any kind of field you're working in, so they also can be used in subsurface hydrology. The downside of R at the moment basically is that the subsurface hydrological community is rather small, despite the fact that all the reproducible research tools are available, and that R also has a lot of other useful things to offer for subsurface hydrologists. So luckily, we have some widely used open source codes for groundwater flow and solute transport modeling available. So Modflow is developed at USGS, MT3D-MS is developed at the University of Alabama. So R interfaces to these two numerical codes would be great. Similar things exist for MATLAB and Python, but given the potential of R, such interfaces would be very interesting. I'm sure you all agree with me on that. So I started compiling packages providing an interface to these codes. I will not go into details today about what can be done with the packages, but basically it's come down to reading, writing, and creating input and output files for the numerical codes and visualization of the data within these files. So the R Modflow package has received a little bit more attention up to now, but you can also do a few interesting things with the RMT3D-MS package already. Despite the fact that you can already do some interesting things, the packages are far from complete, of course. So I listed here all the Modflow and MT3D-DMS packages, and the ones in color are basically the ones that are supported in the R packages at the moment. So if there are any hydrogeologists in the audience, I would love to talk to you about your potential contributions. Okay, so back to reproducible research. So basically what these packages allow you to do now is to have the complete modeling workflow within a single R Markdown or SWIF file. So you can start by specifying boundary conditions, the material parameters, your numerical grid, then you can write out the input files for the numerical code. You can run the numerical code on your model, read in the output files, and then plot the raw data, basically, or just process the data and make some specific types of plots. For the plotting, we are currently using the S3 methods. Okay, so for more information on the packages, please have a look at the package.dll websites. The URLs are there. And I guess maybe we have some time for questions. Yeah, I noticed
which
one.
Here?
Oh, it's zero. But I noticed one of my slides, which I copied a few times, still took only 20 seconds, so I have no idea where we are right now.
That's been zero since the first
one. Okay.
Oh, okay. All right.
So
let's have a
no
go, but I'm cutting it off if the slide comes up. So any questions on this talk?
What's the biggest data you use to run the process?
Excuse me? No, it's not really designed for handling bigger data, no. But normally that's not a big problem with the typical kind of models we work
okay.
With.
I'm going to, sorry.
Yeah, sorry.
Let you finish that up later. Our next speaker is Mayel Simon. She's going to talk about using an R package as a platform for harmonized cleaning of data.
So my talk will be about how we use an R package as a platform for harmonized cleaning of data from RTI MacroPem air quality sensors. This work was done for the CHAI project. CHAI means cardiovascular health effect of air pollution in Telangana, India. So in that project, we are particularly interested in the exposure of people to PM2.5, which are very small particles in the air that have diverse adverse health effects. And we wanted to have time-resolved exposure data so that we could compare this time-resolved information with other information and know whether, for instance, traffic was a high source of exposure for PM2.5 in the population. For that, we used that device. Oops, I didn't want to do that. Okay, sorry. I thought it was a pointer. So the MacroPem is this gray device. It's a small-sized device, and it provides time-resolved data. But the downside is that it's still a prototype, so it doesn't give perfect data. We use this in the type project with GPS, accelerometer, and a rebel camera. So what the device gives you is a so-called CSV, .csv, but it's not a CSV. So you see there is the top of the file that has information about settings for your, say, 24 hours measurement sessions, and then below you have the measurement themselves. So this is not a tabular format that you can use directly, which was the main motivation to write R code, and we decided to create an open source R package in R because everything else in our project would use R to deal with this weird output, to explore files in an easy way, and also to document our data cleaning process. So in that package, each file, which corresponds to a measurement session of, say, 24 hours, is represented by an R6 class object, which has settings and the measurements as two data frames. And there are several methods, including a plotting method. So here you can see measurements over time of temperature, PM2.5, relative humidity, etc. But some members of our project were not R users, and we wanted them to be able to check files at the end of each measurement session to know whether we had to repeat the measurement day for that individual. So we developed a Shiny app for that, where they could just upload the file and see a table with summary of the session, see if anything was wrong with that. And they could also get alarms, so say we had decided that a given parameter should be free in all our measurement session. If at the end of the day we realized that it was not the case, well, the person looking at the file would see this table, see the alarm, and contact someone to deal with this in the following sessions. At the end of doing that in our project, we had more than 250 files, which we converted by writing a function called batch convert, which reads several MacroPem files and convert the settings and the measurement tables to two CSVs. So one with the settings, one with the measurements. But this data that we then wanted to use was not perfect either. So we had a lot of issues with this device. For instance, negative relative humidity, which is not possible. Other teams using the same devices told us, yeah, we had issue with MacroPems, but it was impossible to find details about their decisions in the literature. So what we did was gathering information from the other teams that had issues, from the manufacturer, and we made our own decisions. So for instance, removing some files, applying some correction to part of the data, and we documented all decisions in the vignette of the package, which is our answer to the question, what was your experience with MicroPAMs? Surely you don't know MicroPAMs, so we get the question quite often. And we then decided to advertise for a package for the MicroPAM user. For that, we did a website with package down. And it actually happened already at least one time that someone found our package by Googling for MicroPAM data and could take advantage of our transparently documenting our data cleaning process. So in general, do I think that we need one package for each scientific device in the world? So maybe if you have one weird output with your device, you will need to write some code, and you could write an R package for that. And as in your case, you don't have a central data cleaning documentation, your package could be that place. But hopefully, manufacturers will give us tabular format out of devices in the future so that you don't need to write custom code for each device. And we could hope for a more transparent documentation of data challenges by the manufacturer themselves in a language agnostic way, so it doesn't need to be in an R package. The future plans for our package is that it's currently under review for the joint submission process of the Journal of Open Source Software, Open Science Software, and our OpenSci. I got two reviews this week, one of them from Lucy, who is sitting at the back. So I will need to use this very useful feedback to improve it and hopefully for the other MicroPAM users.
Thank you. All right, our next speaker is Andy South. He's going to talk about map data from natural earth, aiming for sustainability through specialization in our OpenSci.
One feels like one can't stop. Okay, my name's Andy South. I like making maps, which I think might have something to do with my surname. I'm going to be talking about this package that I just released recently. I've been working as a kind of freelance R person for a couple of years, and I find it a little bit tricky kind of combining contributing to the community and sort of along with the normal day job. So that's kind of where the sustainability sort of thing comes in. So how do you, you know, in your code, how can you make sure, or how can you help to sort of say that what you're doing is sustainable? And my kind of two tips are, A, do less, and B, collaborate. So Our Natural Earth just released recently. It's been downloaded about 1,000 times so far. It basically gives you access to this Natural Earth map data, which is sort of country polygon boundaries. There's some pre-downloaded stuff. You can subset relatively easily by countries and regions. And this comes from experience from my previous package, which was kind of 7 years ago, Our World Map, which has been downloaded 100,000 times rather than 1,000 times. But I think I tried to do too much. I mean, probably it was the best thing for doing some things for a while, but now I wouldn't recommend that you use it. And so this is kind of the sort of like new philosophy. Do one thing and do it well, and write something that kind of works together with other stuff. So I wanted to do something that does less and will fit together with other stuff that's within the ecosystem.
Oh, I can bring this.
Ah, right. So Natural Earth, these are the data. So they've been around for a while. You know, people use them for web mapping and all sorts of things. One of the nice things is that they're at different scales. Country boundaries, some raster data, some other things as well. Anyone like to guess what this is? Belgium. All right, so this is Belgium at the kind of smallest scale, which you might not think was very useful, but actually if you're, you know, plotting a map of the world, then you probably don't want it to be kind of any more detailed than this, or those wiggly little lines get in the way. But you can get things at a kind of finer resolution. So this, the NE underscore countries, is from the Natural Earth package, and you can just specify a country and you specify the scale. And this returns an SP object and is just using the SP plot methods to plot here. It will also return an SF object if you choose a different argument. And you can get a map of the whole world. And so again, here we can see the one on the top where you've got the medium resolution actually looks a bit uglier because you've got all those nasty wiggly lines kind of confusing things. So sometimes it is better to have lines that have fewer points. And you've also got more control over how you get the data back. So If you get France as the default, you get French Guiana in there as kind of an extra option, but that's kind of annoying if you're trying to plot a map of Europe. And so you can specify particular options to get back just France. And likewise with the UK, you can specify that you want to get back England, Scotland and Wales rather than just the UK, and that allows you to map things. And then this shows how you can combine it with the wonderful T-map that Martine was describing earlier. You can take the object that comes from Natural Earth and use it in T-map. And then these show the kind of different other data that you can download. So there's, you know, rivers and lakes and other things. And so I went through the R OpenSci open peer review process, which I would highly recommend to anyone. So the great thing about that was that you get people to kind of advise you on particular things in the package. It's a very nice open process, and if you get any kind of really annoying technical details, it can help you solve them. And I've been supported by the Software Sustainability Foundation in the UK. Look them up. They provide fellowships for people in the UK, just like a few thousand euros to kind of facilitate me coming to something like this and running your own things. And they also have got great resources on kind of making software better in research. And then you kind of put your package out there and you never really quite know how it's going to be received. But yeah, it seems like people kind of like this small thing that kind of fits into the ecosystem and hopefully is useful for people. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Has Eve Brustow made it? Yes, wonderful. All right, he will be our next speaker talking about OpenSpat Spread the Spatial World.
Well, hello everybody. Thank you for joining us for this Lightning Talk Marathon. So I'm Yves Rostow, I'm from the University of Liège, and I'm here to talk about you about the OpenSpat project, which is an educational project from the European Union for lifelong learning. So the aim of this project was to build learning modules on spatial data analysis based on open and freely available tools, and which would be focused on practice and peer learning more than on a theoretical aspect. So this project is conducted by three partners, so Liège University, Montpellier Supagro, and the University of Lisboa, and is founded by the Erasmus Plus Key Action 2 Strategic Partnership for Adult Education. So the project, why this project? Because we know, especially here, that there is an increasing availability of spatial data with satellite imagery, drone, GPS, and lots of application in agronomy, land use planning, environmental science. Spatial data is nearly everywhere and available to non-specialists. But for those non-specialists, they need skills and tools to use efficiently those data. So we choose to build these learning modules to get those skills, especially with free tools so that they can bring back those skills to their organization. So the learning modules, an online practical modules, and some face-to-face session with straightforward topics, access to data, spatial correlation, regulation on spatial correlated data, pattern analysis, and so on. The practical course is just an introduction to the OpenSpat project. It contains an overview of the contents of the face-to-face session, which comes next, and also a link to the QGIS community for some information about the link between QGIS and R. The face-to-face session were organized on standard day schedules with, in the morning, background theory and technical introduction to the tools from R, and PM, real case studies in peer learning with all the students. We use some, beside from R, some free available tools like R Markdown documents, to add the interactivity with the documents we use and to add reproducibility to the examples that we use. We also use the tools Scenery, which to mix together the videos, the written documents, and multiple choice questions that were given to the students, and Plickers for the interactivity during the face-to-face session. So all these tools are freely available. This year was a test drive. We use students from the three partners institution as test. So they come from different countries, they had different backgrounds, and they were assigned surveys about, well, the contents and the organization of the course and their motivation. So for their motivation and self-efficacy, you can see that they feel more confident about their skills in spatial data analysis after the third module, which is quite good for us. And also for the backgrounds of the people, which was seen at first as a drawback from because they were very different. It was in fact an asset because they really appreciate working together with people with very different backgrounds so that they, in the real case study, they can exchange their own experience. Some of them were more statistician or geometrician, so it was very good for us. So also the choice of open source tools was very good because they had some backgrounds and also they could keep those information and go back to their institution with them because everybody can install AIR very easily, so there was no barrier. What's next for next year? Well, we will use these surveys of the student to improve the content, and so the next year session will be here in Belgium, and we also go to the blended learning, so the exercise will be online and no more from face to face. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next speaker will be Tobias Galster, talking about calculating hydrological metrics for univariate time series.
Okay. Yeah, hello. It's great to be here. My name is Tobias, and I'm going to introduce the package SMIRES, which offers a framework for calculating hydrological metrics or ecological metrics for univariate time series. SMIRES is also the name of a huge EU project researching intermittent streams. These are streams which fall dry regularly. In this project, we have to calculate lots of similar metrics, and instead of implementing every metric in a single function, we developed a general framework doing so. Okay, this R package provides this framework and also provides lots of sample data sets, hydrological sample data sets. It is primarily aimed at unexperienced R users, and we try to keep the requirements on the input data as low as possible. For example, we can work with binary data, and we try to be clever when it comes to handling missing values. There are two main functions, the function metric, which is here for analyzing continuous variables, and the function SMIRES for binary time series. And we also provide some low-level functions as well as predicate functions which are able to check for intermittency. If we want to compute our first metric, for example, the mean annual maximum discharge for the river Boulder is 4.5 cubic meters per second, and that many hydrological variables are constructed in such a way that you split your time series in years, you aggregate each year, and then aggregate all years again to obtain a single value at the end. And this function metric gives you complete choice over the aggregation intervals and about your aggregation functions, and you can even shift the start of your hydrological year to some day. If you omit the final aggregation function and you just supply a function for your major interval, which are years per default, you will get the yearly aggregates. Internally, all this aggregation and splitting is handled by dplyr. Now I want to talk about binary time series. This is done by the function SMIRES. It derives a binary time series from given time series. And in this plot, you see the red segments. These are states where the river is very dry, where your threshold is below your discharge is below a given threshold. This threshold can easily be varied. In either case, you will always get a table where one row corresponds to an event with a unique event ID, a given state, a start and an end date of this event, together with some other useful grouping variables. If you want to compute a metric for a binary time series, this is very easy. Please just look on the right side. You have to specify your input time series. You have to specify an aggregation function for your major period. You have to come up with a final aggregation function. And you have to somehow say how to handle NAs. I do not want to go too much into detail on this slide. The complexity of the package lies not within the aggregation. This is reliably done by dplyr. But in the flexible specification of your intervals, of the minor intervals and of the major intervals. For example, one can very easily carry out seasonal analysis by using seasons as your minor interval. These are the starts of the season. For example, in Europe, in Europe's climate, four seasons would be appropriate, whereas in Africa or India, there might only be two seasons, rainy season and not so rainy season. Okay, to sum it up, this package provides a flexible and powerful framework to compute metrics for univariate time series. They could be either continuous or binary. The user has complete or free choice of the aggregation period and of the aggregation function. The project is hosted on GitHub, so if you like the project, please use it and give me feedback. And finally, I want to acknowledge COAST and the European Union for enabling me to work on this package. And I want to thank you for the endurance to listening to my 20 seconds per slide madness. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Our next speaker is Shwetank Lal, who's going to talk about minimal RSD and FMC, R packages to construct cost-efficient experimental designs.
Ladies and gentlemen, a very good evening. I'm Shwetank Lal. I'm currently doing PhD at Indian Agricultural Statistics Research Institute. And my packages are not so good. I mean to say it's targeted to specific users, especially for industrial, who are doing industrial experiments and agricultural experiments, especially in the field of post-harvest technology, food processing. So what happened, we recently developed some new package, new methodologies, especially design of experiments, and we communicated our paper to the journal, and the journal was very happy to accept our paper. But they told that, yeah, SAS codes are good, but can you make something in R? So that's why we developed two R packages. One FMC focuses on factorial experimental designs, and the second one is minimal RSD, which focuses on response surface designs. So this is the outline of my presentation right now. So as we know, in design of experiments, factorial experiments are targets testing of hypotheses where usually the factors are qualitative, we take levels there. And when we talk about response surface designs, they usually focus on estimation and optimization, so the factors are usually quantitative in nature, and there are experimental runs. So what the main motivation is from my institute, my neighboring institute, Indian Agricultural Research Institute. What is there? We have a soil microbial diversity research, where see carbon dioxide is the factor which is very hard to change in the biolog ecoplate. Rest fertilizer and variety, wheat variety is very easy to change. So changing carbon dioxide will cost a lot of money, time, and effort. So such type of factors are called hard to change factor. They are very difficult to change. So what we want to do is we have to give the sequence of experimental runs which have minimum number of level of changes. So we developed for all sort of designs, factorial and everything, the methodologies, and this is the package. So here on my left hand side, you can see the usual factorial design, and we have got, you can see, we have many changes in carbon dioxide, but when we use my package, FMC, we are getting only one level of changes. So that makes a lot of sense for those who really have a difficult time changing the factorial levels. So coming to one of our publications here, we have given the minimum possible number of changes for the factorial experiment. This is given by this formula. And here, we have given here the input is jet, which is a sequence of levels of each factor. And next slide, I'm explaining this slide, how to construct this one. This is the methodology we have developed. As we can see, the first, the left-hand side, the first factor is very hard to change. So the next, we start from the last factor. So we, you can see the yellow box is reverse replicated according to the number of times the previous factor is there. So in the same way, we just do replications. So this is one of the, this was one of the method of construction. So every design, we have different type of construction methods we employed. In response of the designs, there are two types of designs. Box Bangan design and central composite designs. Box Bangan design usually consists of the that incidence matrix of BIBD and other thing. Let's leave that. Then coming to response surface designs, we have central composite designs which consist of factorial points, axial points, and center points. So we have given a way of arranging them so that we can get the minimum number of level changes, which will really make sure the experimenter saves lot of money, resources, and effort. So these are the two outputs. It's very simple to use package, minimal RSD. If you want to make box Bangan design, you talk BBD and give the number of factors which is in your experiment. You get a design, you employ, and save money here. The same way, you can go for central composite design. So in the next slide, I'm giving the discussion here. What really is happening, our publications guarantee that yes, the design you are getting is minimally, it has minimum number of level changes, and it has got a lot of good applications in all the fields, agricultural, veterinary, and food processing, post-harvest technology like that. And here are the upcoming updates. In my next updates, I'm going to add Shiny apps and also some new type of designs we have worked out. We are going to add in these two packages. And thank you. And this is next slide. There's the advisory committee, my PhD advisory committee, which I would like to acknowledge. Any question? These are references, which are publications. So I think we have 20 seconds. Any question if there? No questions.
I don't know if we're going to get the chance to get the answer for a 20-second question. So we'll save the questions for the end, but thank you very much. Very interesting talk.
Thank you
very
much. See you.
All right, our next talk. I'm sorry, you have one more slide. I didn't realize. We have 40 seconds. It'll give you a chance to think about it. Does somebody have a question they want to throw out right now? No, all right, at the end. Okay, well, thank you so much. Our next to last penultimate speaker is Joni Verta, going to talk about IC test, estimating the number of interesting components.
Okay, thank you. So I'm Joni from Finland, and I'm going to talk about our R package called IC test, estimating the number of interesting components. So you can think, for example, about PCA, there you get your principal components, but what is the correct number of components to keep? How many components should you retain? What is too much? What is too little? So we're going to try to answer that and similar questions. And so the package, you can find it from Kran. It's made by our team, and it, apart from the PCA, it provides similar functions for estimating the dimension in various cases, classical cases for dimension reduction. So some classical multivariate methods. And before I show you any examples, first I'll talk about our model. So the model is a basic latent factor model where the latent variable z contains two parts. The s is interesting and the n is non-interesting. And what that means in practice is depends on the situation. But s is something we want to find and n is something not important. And how this goes in practice, you get a sample from the model, so n vectors, and you want to estimate the signal s. The problem is that most of the methods that do something like this, they assume that the dimension of the signal is known. So you know k, the dimension a priori, and that is not the case in practice often. There's no reason why you should know the latent dimension. And our solution is a sequential hypothesis testing. So first you test whether the dimension is 0, 1, 2, and so on, until you first accept, and that is your dimension. And we actually have two kinds of tests, asymptotic and bootstrap based, but I don't have the time to go into details in this talk. So next, let's take a look at some examples. So first, regression. You want to regress y on x, and now we assume that the s, the interesting part, contains k predictors, and the non-interesting part contains just some noise that doesn't explain why. And we want to estimate the s because then we avoid the problem of collinearity, and also maybe do some kind of feature selection. So very basic example, and now I create some data here. Because I create the data, I can choose that the true dimension is 1. So k equals 1, that is what we're trying to estimate with the package. And 200 observations, something very simple. We just go along with the model I just showed you. So let's see what the package can do with this data. So first we test whether the dimension is zero, we get a p-value very small or 0.004 or something. So we reject that it's not a true dimension, and then we check whether it's one, we get a higher p-value, and we accept that we have correctly found the true dimension k equals one. The functions correctly found with hypothesis testing the true amount of components. Here's still a plot of the components. The top row shows the scatter plot of the response and the original variables. They're nothing in the top row. And the leftmost column shows the scatter plots between y and the found variables. You can clearly see the one single component. It has the curved red shape there. So it certainly looks like a signal. And then a second example, independent component analysis, where now we redefine interestingness to be non-Gaussianity. So everything that's non-Gaussian is interesting, and anything that's Gaussian is non-interesting. So Gaussianity is noise, and non-Gaussianity is something interesting. Let's try to find the non-Gaussianity from an example. So here's our data. This is what we observe. This is the X. I created this data, so I know that there's K is 3. There's 3 signals hidden somewhere. There are 3 latent signals, and total number of variables is 6 images. Let's see what the package thinks of this data. So hopefully we find K signals. And first we try whether the dimension is 2. A small p-value, meaning that we reject. It's not a true dimension. Then whether it's 3, and we go above the threshold 0.05 and conclude correctly that the dimension is 3. And we can still take a look at the signal. So this is what the method found. So the top row is what the method thinks are the signals, and they certainly look more like signals than the lower row, and the lower row is the found noise. And there's 2 examples, and what else is in the package? There's also PCA I mentioned, but I didn't include example of PCA because PCA is much more boring than these 2 methods, and every function has 2 versions, the asymptotical version which works for high sample sizes and the bootstrap version which works for low and high sample sizes both, so you can take your pick. And then finally some references, so the package itself and 2 papers about the theory behind the methods. So thank you.
Thank you so much. I've never been to a lightning talk where people finish early. This is amazing. Excellent job by all of the speakers. Thank you. Thank you so much to all of the speakers for some fascinating talks and for doing such a great job with this kind of creative format. Most of the speakers are sitting up towards the front, so if you do have questions, please come down and find them. Otherwise, have a wonderful time at the conference dinner tonight, and let's finish up with one more round of applause for the speakers.